carrier, why shouldn't you you break with the key, your carrier, and the phone? I don't understand that. Back to you.
I understand your question. Gordon, what do you think were the designations, and was there an American equivalent where the carrier went on and off, even though it had a tone on it? Over to you, Gordon.
We did not. What typically would happen, MCW was used when you had all these radios that were at least transmitters that were AM, and yeah, some guys did do the code practice oscillator thing, but some people actually directly coupled a tone directly into the audio circuit of an AM signal, and they did this because they had no reliable way to generate CW, and turning the carrier on off was, shall we say, a gut-wrenching proposition for you, the transmitter, the changeover relay system, etc. And so a lot of us did that. In fact, I'm among them. I had a TDQ transmitter that did not have the capability for Morse code. So I did MCW, and my receiver was a Techcraft or an AZL converter, depending on which one I had at the time. And you know, my receiver, the underlying receiver side was an ARC 5 receiver from 6 to 9 megahertz with a 40 megahertz, probably a 40 meter IF, if you can believe it, at 145 megahertz. So 6 megahertz was 144, 7 megahertz, where technicians could operate at 145. And I had put a BFO into my ARC 5 receiver. And so I receive other people's MCW as well. And the net effect of that was that, you know, where you couldn't understand the modulation of a voice, you could understand the modulation of the tone on and off, you know, with a BFO driven MCW.
Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, and you know, well, Gordon brings up a very interesting point.
One point. The point that you're missing is the real reason for breaking up the carrier was to just give the break to the transmitter so it could transmit with the higher power. Why nobody mentioned that?
There's a much more important thing going on here that Gordon is bringing to our attention, and that is many of the VHF transmitters, before frequency synthesizers were invented, had an awful lot of chirp every time they went on the air and off the air. Therefore, you don't want to interrupt the carrier. Each time you interrupt the carrier, the transmitter would come back on with a chirp at VHF frequencies, and maybe even at HF frequencies. Now, maybe you guys in Europe had oscillators that were so high in Q that when you completely turned them on and off, they didn't chirp. We weren't quite that skilled, Wesley, so therefore I think we left the carrier on, even though you guys in Europe took it off. And 2XJN, K2RIW in the segment.
C2, QIQ with a comment? Sweep.
That was a good one. Dick, thank you very much. I've got the... Okay. Well, the thing is, in America there is elegance in the signal. In Europe, especially Eastern Europe, there was no need for elegance of the signal. There was a need for communication. In many situations and instances, the technology was not developed to the straight level. And the designers were going from the point, were coming from the point that if we had ahead of time the sparking Morse code, it's no problem with the creeping one. But at that time, you have a lot of more power generated because in the meantime between the pulses you have a transmitter taking the break. Am I right? And
yeah, it's a little bit like the peak envelope power readings of single sideband transmitter. You're absolutely right. You're saving battery power, you're saving tube heating if the tube transmitter is taking a break in between. So as long as you don't have a chirp problem, there's a definite advantage in turning off the carrier on an MCW signal. KT2QIQ, go ahead, Glenn.
The term that you guys were looking for was called full break-in.
Yeah, everything before that, the old transmitters where you just had the key on button, that was CW, that was A1. A1 was your, basically you tuned up your carrier. Then when you started keying down, basically you were adding your 1 kilohertz tone and sending your CW. It wasn't until later that eventually, you know, you weren't clanking all the relays around and sending out all the chirps and the other noise, and we had full break-in. So I think that's the term you guys were looking for, KC2, QIQ.
Oh, but it was more than that. Not necessarily, Glenn. Full break-in means that in between each let-up of the key, between dots and dashes, your transmitter and receiver truly flipped over to the receiver mode. And the receiver was quick enough in recovery. You put in the right kind of circuit so the receiver would recover from that tremendous signal coming from the transmitter. Therefore, if a guy wants to break in with you, while you've got a nice long-winded transmission in Morse code, and the guy wants to break in, and if you've got full break-in capability, in between your dots and dashes, you hear him sending dots to you saying he wants to break in. Please stop sending. I gotta stop what you're saying in order to put something in. That's my understanding of full break-in. You heard what was going on the band in between the times you let up the key. Anyone want to put in the key?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm agreeing with you, Dick. I'm saying that's the benefit of full break-in. In other words, the idea was that initially you didn't have full break-in. In other words, you had basically your CW signal, you tuned up, you put your tone on, and you started clanking away. When you were done, you unkeyed your transmitter. And then later on, when they finally came out with full break-in, you're right. Then now that you were sending the pulses and you had a transceiver, and your receiver was on instantly right after the break in the transmission pulse, at that point, yes, you could hear. But let me pass it back to you, K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Have QSK until recent times, Dick.
Of course, every transmitter, every transceiver has the same capability. My 2000 Kenwood has a capability of full breaking.
Yeah, we're trying to say here something more than that. Hold on. Grab it. Okay. Consider this, guys. Back in those days, you had Dow key relays on your transmit receive stuff. So you weren't going to be doing, you didn't want to even think about gratuitously banging that thing between receive and transmit, you know, a lot, number one. Number two, the inside of, let's say, my TDQ transmitter, it's 100 watts input, you know, I think it was a 826 or 829 amplifier, if I remember right, built into it. I mean, you didn't want to be lighting that puppy up and switching over all its internal circuitry between transmit and idle gratuitously. And that's why you ran MCW. It was a matter of saving battery power. Ran on 110 and, you know, heated your room. It was a 24-inch, you know, Navy rack. It was a sight to behold. And I had my little, you know, Techcraft or AZL converter sitting on the desk next to, you know, a tiny, relatively speaking, modified archive receiver for 6 to 9 megahertz. You know, I mean, and that was it. The key, you had a transmit button, transmit receive button that you, or lever that you flipped, and then you started sending Morse code, or you grabbed the microphone and started talking. That was totally, you know, you did that with a stable carrier, as Dick suggests. And by the way, with not so much with the TDQ, Dick, but with other transmitters you might have had, you didn't have a chirp. You had a swing onto the frequency. So it time constant was sometimes even longer than that would be considered acceptable for a chirp, as well as the frequency excursion that went with it.
You think whenever you heard Dick in old times something like ew, that was actually that's what you've got from A2 back to you.
Eric wants to say something. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah. You started out by saying what's A1 and A2. If you go to the FCC website or you just Google FCC emission designators, you'll find out that the A stands for amplitude modulation double sideband, you'll find out that A0 is no modulation at all in the nature of modulating signal. One, as far as the FCC is concerned, is considered to be digital, on-off, or quantized, no modulation. A2, or the number 2, is considered to be digital with modulation. So when you're doing RTTY and that kind of stuff, you're transmitting A2. And if you're doing A3, that's a single analog channel. If you're doing A7, that would be two or more digital channels. If you're doing A8, it's two or more analog channels, etc., 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 etc. And these, by the way, are ITU designations, which actually is part of the World Administrative Radio Conference, meaning that it's designated like this for the entire world.
And we come to the conclusion. Is then A2, if it's digital, considered to be square wave?
Well, let me ask you this question about the new clean format that we have today. They weren't always that neat and pretty, W2TPG. Eric, I've got a main question for you. You described A0, 1, 2, 3, 4. Which of the A's really turn the carrier on and off with Morse code? A0 for sure, or maybe A1. Did A2 turn the carrier on and off with the Morse code? Over to you, Eric.
The only one that specifies the carrier being turned on or off is the number 1.
KC2, QIQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Only going to specify the on state, not the off state. So A1, A2. A2 is CW. That's your Morse code CW, A2. It's really just the on state. They don't specify the off state.
That's not true. The designator states 0 is no modulation, okay, which means no signal. 1 specifies as on-off, no modulation. 2 specifies digital with modulation. That's simply what the rules say.
Yeah. Hey, Eric, but are you telling me that when you're sending Morse code over amateur radio that it's not A2? I'm pretty sure it's A2.
No other way. If A0 would not be on-off, there would be no A0. So at the same point, if it is not said that A2 is no off and all, it does not specify, that means that you have a right to have on and off.
CW is A1. MIDI and that kind of stuff that could be AFSK would be A2.
AFSK is A2. A1 is CW.
Both CW.
I think A0 is a steady carrier with no modulation. A1 is conventional Morse code. A2 is modulated Morse code. And the one thing that's not super clear is the carrier going on and off with A2? What do you say, Eric?
The list specifies A1 as the only thing with the carrier going on and off. It specifically says on, off.
Okay, so you believe those are the international rules, and therefore, in theory, the Europeans were following those rules, is what you believe, Eric. Go ahead.
Now, when you guys talk about modulated CW, okay, if you had a Goonie box or you had a lunch box, there's no way in hell that you would be switching that carrier on and off with those devices. I mean, they even took, like, you know, 500 or 700 milliseconds, if you even come up.
Right, if there would be no switching on and off in the ruling of FCC, there would be no A1.
It's the on-off state of the analog information in the case of A2, which could be modulated CW. If the carrier happens to follow the modulation, so be it. But it's a secondary concern. The primary concern is the fact that you're modulating a carrier with a tone and sending information with the tone. If the carrier happens to follow, so be it.
Right on.
Well, again, think the FTC site and the ICU site, and I'm looking at both of them, specifically say that A1 and A2 are digital forms of transmission. A1 is a digital form which is basically on and off, okay, with no modulation. And A2, or F2, or whatever you want to call it, is digital with modulation. Does not specify that the carrier goes on and off, period.
Use it again, guys. I'm sorry I'm interrupting you.
It doesn't matter. It's what you do to the carrier when it's on. It's what they're talking about. If you didn't have to worry about what you put on the carrier, then and you were just toggling the carrier, then you'd have the degenerate case of A1. It's a cumulative kind of system. I mean, I get it.
I'm trying to see the word. Oh, there is no A1 if there is no on and off. That's why they put in the ruling on and off, because there will be no A1 in a Morse code. Simple like that. The same is with A0. But they didn't put that in A2 because it is understandable that whether you break the carrier and break the tone, or just break the tone without breaking the carrier, you can do it as well. Back to you.
Well, by the way, if you scroll down, if you do a Google search for the ITU setting, it will show you use old and new, because we have the old system and the new system. And one called pure carrier, use, pure carrier, A0 or F0 in the old system, and the new system is N0N. Morse code telegraphy by ear is A1 or A1A in the new system. Modulated CW Morse is A2 or A2A. AM voice is A3 or A3E. Single sideband suppressed carrier is A3J, or now it's called J3E. Single sideband reduced carrier is A3R, now called R3E. Single sideband full carrier, by the way, which exists, is A3H, A3E in the new system. Television, which is considered to be A5 in the old system, the new system is C3F, etc., etc., etc.
What was Pulse? Is Pulse in there?
Let's see, we got packet data telephonage with audio subcarrier, which is AFSK, that's 20F2. Data with audio subcarrier is a whole bunch of them, analog voice, digital voice. Keep going, digital data. Microwave emissions. And I don't see anything that specifically says pulse, but let me look, because there's still a lot more. Oh, there it is. Emission of pulses. The emission designator is P. It's sequence of pulses. If it's amplitude modulated, it's a K, which is a suffix. Modulated by width or duration is L. Modulation by position or phase is M. And the carrier is angle modulated is Q, and the combination produced by any other means for cases not covered is V and W.
Well, if I was a European and I really wanted to turn off the carrier and I didn't want the transmitter to do swooping and chirping and whatever, and if I'm a real smart designer, I design an oscillator that runs continuously and has an extremely well-regulated power supply. I send that oscillator output through a number of isolating amplifier stages so that anything downrange doesn't get coupled uprange. Then that last stage, or second to the last stage, I find a way of turning it on and off if I want to kill the carrier, whether it be modulated CW or whatever. In that way, I could have a transmitter that doesn't have chirp and swoop, but it takes a lot of extra design to do that. Most transmitters, when you turn on and off the final stage, you're changing the current drain to the power supply, which gets coupled back to the oscillator by two different means, power supply modulation, as well as changing the impedance that the crystal sees, and therefore it chirps and swoops. As I see it, I could design one that does it, but I got to work real hard, and When I do that, I tend to have what they call a back wave. When I lift up the key and I'm only killing the last stage or the last two stages, it may be 70 dB down, but there is a key up signal there, and I've heard those on the air. That's called the back wave problem. So to avoid back wave, to avoid chirp and whatever, if I'm really turning on and off the carrier with modulated CW, is very difficult. Do you believe, Wesley, that you Europeans did all that in 2XJN, K2RIW on the TechNet?
Well, Dick, let me give you a little bit of the history. At first, the A2 was invented for the Russian spies long time ago. The reason for that was that they didn't have to have a special piece of equipment. They went to the foreign country to spy on others, and they could use a regular receiver just to receive the CW coded. That was one of the single reasons why it was that. And when you have a steady carrier and you sync, or you just use the code, or you use the tone, whatever, it's A3. It's never A2. It's simple like that, because there would be no distinction between A2 and A3. Nobody specified that it has to be a 1,000 hertz, so nobody specified even a sync on it. With the Morse code. Back to you, enter exit.
I think the usual interpretation of A3 is that the modulation there is human speech. Not, I don't think A3 was ever used as a Morse code technique. What do you think, Eric?
A3, as far as the world is concerned, is amplitude modulation, which is intended for music and speech and that kind of stuff. Don't forget, they always started making these designators in the late 30s, I think it was. And I look up the history. Whether or not Wesley thinks that A3 was invented for the Russians, I somehow rather doubt that. You know, a lot of this stuff, as radio was broadcasting came about, even in the beginning, like, the police department had radios, and they were operating at the lower part of what we call the broadcast band today, so, you know, I don't know. I wasn't alive back then, but I can look at the designators and see what they say, and they specifically spell out modulation type, carrier, what the purpose of the modulation, what kind of intelligence there is, so. You go by that, you got A1 is CW, A2 is modulated CW, as a lot of us hams used in the 50s and 60s, and before, because we didn't have the technology to turn things on and off, especially at the higher frequency. And A3 is AM. You know, we even had television as Avon, and that occurred around the 50s, so what can I tell you?
That's right, K2KEY.
Eric? If television was A5, out of curiosity, what was A4?
No light.
Facsimile. Okay, Mel, you want to say something?
Dug out the original regulations when you and I took the test pick back in the 50s. And when you had to memorize, A1 was CW. For instance, on the 80-meter band, what was authorized? You were authorized to run between 3500 and 3725 A1 only. You were authorized from 3725 to 4 megahertz, A1 and A3. In other words, A3 is amplitude modulated phone. Caution! You are never authorized to use A0. A0 means unmodulated carrier. And then there was, of course, A4, which facsimile, A5 television. Then there was F1 with frequency shift keying. F2 is frequency modulated tone keying, also known as Morse teletype. That was also for a while there. around Dick. So this is basically, and let me drop and I'll say one more word.
You said some magic words there, and that is, if A0 is never authorized, and implies that it is illegal to put out a steady carrier to tune up your transmitter on the air, even if you're in a blank spot. Over to you, Mel.
Exactly. Now, A0, it's a prohibitive. A0, you had to remember that, if they slip that in as a, you know, a test question. All I'm going to tell you, back in the early days when they finally authorized these hams over in Eastern Europe to get on the air, they had the worst sounding CW signals especially. They were full of lousy filtering. They never had a good tone coming out of them. Much hurt was the least of it, but they had sound like they were using straight AC in many cases. Very, if they sent fast CW, you couldn't make copy on it, Dick. So they surely didn't have the technology, I think, that we had in this country, at least not the hands over.
That is exactly true. Exactly true. That's why I strongly state that A2, when it was used the way that I described, it was not good quality. They didn't care about the quality. They care about the battery power and other factors.
W2TTT. Go ahead, Gordon. You know, one of the things that you guys are ignoring, you're concentrating on the modulation side, but for the qualitative benefit that lies between phone, whether it's AM phone and classic A1 CW, by using A2 CW, and that is that you can, you know, you don't have to worry about the complications of recovering the speech pattern, and you get about 10 or more dB of signal to noise ratio, and I would argue another 10 dB in your head of intelligibility recovery that you can work with an MCW signal, an amplitude modulated MCW signal, that you couldn't, let's say, with an AM phone signal. And that's another way of getting more bang for your buck out of your transmitting signal. And I used to DX all up and down the East Coast with MCW in the 70s, late 70s, before I had any money. And, you know, there's a practical reason for doing this other than the dealing with the encumbrances of transmit receive and frequency stability and the like. Anyway, we can debate that another day. K2RAW, W2TTT.
Dick, as far as A2, I'll tell you what the regulation was.
Go ahead, Mel.
A2, also known as MCW, is only authorized on from 50.050 to 51 megahertz. And then, let's see, from 51 to 54 megahertz. And on 2 meters, it was 144.100, 144.100, 148.000, A2 was authorized. They did not have any authorization for A2 in 220 megahertz, but did have authorization for it in the 400 and the 70 centimeters. So, but no A2 authorized in anything below 50 megahertz, over.
Still okay today. Mel, you're reading the rules for what year? Is that modern or is that 1950, so to speak? Mel, go ahead.
Let me see, what year is this? 1955.
And I presume that has changed somewhat since then, or do you think the A2 rules are almost the same? What do you think?
I believe MCW is still same thing. I believe it's no authorization under 50 megahertz for MCW. I may be wrong, but I'm 99% sure that's the way the rule still sits.
Now, Gordon said something that's interesting. If I go from A3 voice modulation down to modulated CW A2, without a doubt you pick up some extra threshold. However, A2 modulated CW is making a carrier possibly going on and off, most likely not, and some sidebands. So you're spreading yourself spectrally. If I go down to A1, pure carrier on and off with no modulation, in a modern-day product detector receiver, with the right kind of video integration that's making more narrowness to the audio passband, just to make it sound more pleasing. I'm convinced that A1 has more threshold than A2 capability. More energy is in the spot where it's really doing the work. I wonder how you feel about that one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
In a mistake there, K2KEY.
Have a good comment about it.
Yeah, let me see what Eric says on that one.
I'm just looking up what's still authorized today, so.
Okay.
Thanks, Dick.
Go ahead, Mel.
You know there was one spot where they permitted A2 below 50 megahertz. That was on 11 meters. It was an amateur radio band. 26960, the only frequency below 50 megahertz where A2 is permitted. Over.
Wow. And that A2 was continuous carrier with the Morse code modulation of tone. The tone turned on and off, but the carrier continuously there. Is that the way you see it, Mel?
I got it, man.
Exactly. Would you believe that was the only authorization where A2 was under 6 meters? There was no other A2 authorized, strictly prohibited, except for 26960. All other amateur radio HF bands are only authorized for A1 and A3, with, of course, F1. F1 came in also approximately the same time frequency shift key, but only in F1 mode. You could no longer use F3 mode, which was Morse operated teletype. They stopped that, Dick. Over.
Interesting. Eric, go ahead. What you find?
Okay, according to 97307, which is the authorized emission standard type. Okay, MCW is allowed on 6 meters between 50.1 and 51. Also, MCW is allowed between 51 and 54. It's allowed at 144.1 to 148. It is allowed on 220, between 222 and 225. It's allowed the entire 70 centimeter band, the entire 33 centimeter band, the entire 23 centimeter band, and anything higher that you can think of that we have. And wow, the FCC is even now labeling the 1 millimeter band. I didn't know that. We have the 6 millimeter band, we got the 4 millimeter band, we got 2.5 millimeter band, we've got 2 millimeters and 1 millimeter, and anything above 300 gig.
AC2, QIQ?
Yep. That famous statement, it used to be all above 3 gigs, then it was all above 30 gigs, and now it's all above 300 gigs. That's the wide open spaces. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, looking at the emission type designators for what we call CW on amateur radio, and right now the FCC, what they're calling it is A1A for amplitude modulated CW with oral reception, and then they have another version of CW which also could be J3E for single sideband suppressed carrier telephony. So those are the two basic CW modes, Dick. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Let's be the customer.
Yeah, go ahead, Alex.
Okay, let me drop.
I met Wesley. I'll eventually get you guys straight. Sorry about that.
In terms of efficiency, let me compare the CW signal to the needle. Then a tree would be something like a thick nail. So, the CW goes the most far because it's the thinnest one. That's the way that that educated us in the army. Then, because A3 was not very much efficient, then the A3J, which is the 10% of carrier, correct me on this one in American rules, was a single side bunch. Now, the single side, when you cut one side bunch, and you count 90% of the carrier, it goes about 16 times with the same power, longer. then it goes with the traditional A3. And additional factor is the frequency and propagation of frequency. That's the whole secret of making the long-range QSO. Dick, can you comment on that?
Yeah, I think I'm pretty strongly in agreement there. When you take a pure A3 amplitude-modulated, 100% amplitude-modulated signal, in theory, the carrier carries no information other than properly deflecting the automatic gain control circuit and telling you how strong the signal is. But it carries no useful information. When you go from double sideband with carrier, ordinary AM, like broadcast AM, and you go over to pure single sideband with no lower sideband, almost or no carrier, and all upper sideband, you could say that everything you're transmitting is intelligence. You could also say that the receiver only needs one half or a little bit less noise equivalent bandwidth. So the receiver has more threshold, the transmitter has more efficiency, the overall combination, I've heard various numbers thrown around, but quite often they say that single sideband is numbers like 8 or 9 decibels more efficient than double sideband AM. I think I've heard numbers like that. Have you heard numbers like that also, Eric? KE2EJ? K2LIW?
In times when you add the receiver part.
No, I agree with you, Dick. I've heard things like that. But let's put it this way. The whole concept of suppressed carrier, even being used in the commercial world, actually they use AC SSB, so that way you don't have to worry about turning it, provides better communication link. And if you look at it from a digital point of view, to give you a lot better, error rate reductions and so on and so forth. But yeah, those are the numbers that are being thrown around.
Yeah, Eric, Wesley called it 8-to-1 advantage, which does calculate to be 9 decibels. Another fairly strong proof of its efficiency is that in the days of wired telephone, where you had the master group and the super group and the master super group and so on, the individual signals that were frequency multiplexed onto a single wire or single carrier for transmission of telephone, each of those individual signals were single sideband. There was a pilot tone somewhere telling you how to make everything come out exactly right in frequency. But the real telephone circuit really was a whole bunch of individual single sideband signals for each individual client. Is that the way you see it, Eric? K3J? K2LIW?
Yeah, K2LIW, K2J. And believe it or not, if you tune to some SDPCs on the satellite, you will find that there's still, to this day, although there's much less of it now because of all the fiber that's in the ground, still the method of transmission of doing bulk communication circuits for telco through satellites.
There's a slight catch with the satellite, though. The overall signal on the satellite, I think, is angular modulated, even though in between, the actual baseband of information, so to speak, is the single sideband amplitude modulated individual client carriers. But I think the overall satellite itself thinks that that uplink signal is a angular modulated signal. What do you think, Eric?
It's QPSK. But the baseband is SSB. Exactly, ACSSB.
I have a question then. Nobody answered me for the whole life this question.
Fire away.
Okay. Guys, I'm going to say something stupid. If I compare this CW to the needle, is that something thinner goes further if you try to, let's say, push the needle into some material? It goes more far than the nail. Is it something that is trench, or is just that I'm thinking about nonsense and just the receiver, because of ability to narrow the filter, is able to receive that better, but there has to be something from the transmitter side. Back to you.
I think in many circumstances what you're describing can be a very good analogy.
A fairly to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, note number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
I think a fairly smart professor could say that the needle has more penetrating power than a nail, that it takes less force to get the same amount of penetration, that the transmission of a narrowband signal in many cases more efficient. However, when you dig into the specifics of what's going on, you will see it on your spectrum analyzer. Set your spectrum analyzer in such a way that you see noise at the bottom of the screen. And look at that noise with a 1 megacycle noise resolution, a 1 megacycle resolution bandwidth. Then switch over to a 100 kilohertz resolution bandwidth. The average noise power on the screen will move down by 10 dB. Every receiver does that. The total noise power that's in the receiver that your signal has to compete with is a function of the resolution bandwidth of the receiver. So if you're using a kind of modulation where you can transmit the information you care about in a more narrowband signal, which allows you to use less bandwidth of the receiver, you will be able to listen to a weaker signal. You could say the signal is like a straight pin and it has more penetration. In reality, the signal strength itself isn't necessarily changing. The receiver is picking up more sensitivity. So where is it really happening? We can argue about that. But it's not a bad analogy. A straight pin has more penetration than a nail.
You can say it's got more dynamic range.
It's got more dynamic range. That's the good news. But the more narrow signal, in many cases, cannot give you as much information bandwidth. The rate at which you transmit megabits of information...
Not quite Voyager, so slow.
But the question then is that anything unusual happening from the transceiver, the transmitter side? Because we're only talking about the receiving part.
You've got rather complete freedom as to how you use your transmitter. It has a finite amount of carrier power, or the equivalent of carrier power. That's the real thing that's transmitted. It takes a carrier at a rather high frequency to propagate through space. Audio, for all practical purposes, doesn't go very far in space. Radio, a higher frequency, does. So you're selecting radio to penetrate space. Now, how you modulate that radio, whether you change its amplitude or its angle, is your choice. The slight advantages and disadvantages of whether you choose angular modulation, amplitude modulation, or some combination, and then life gets complicated when you start using subcarriers and nonlinear modulation techniques and the 16 quad amplitude modulation. You can use all kinds of fancy modulation techniques, and now you're obeying Shannon's laws as to modulation rate, which means bandwidth of signal, and how much signal dynamic range it has. How weak can the signal be and still be interpreting it? If your signal-to-noise ratio, let me drop. If you have the luxury to make the transmitter strong enough, the antenna gain large enough, the line of sight good enough, and the receiver signal sensitivity good enough, if you have the luxury to do all those things, so that your average signal-to-noise ratio, instead of being 10 dB, which is acceptable, 20 dB, which is great, 30 dB is getting into hi-fi, 40 and 50 dB is getting into broadcast standard, once you start getting higher and higher signal-to-noise ratio, you now have the ability to use more and more modulation, more and more exotic modulation techniques, so that now you can transmit more and more data per symbol is the way it's described. And that takes a whole lot of explanation as to what are the number of bits per symbol that's transmitted.
You didn't answer the question. My question was, you have a 6 kilohertz of signal, and you have a 300 hertz signal. One is CW, and the other one is the A3, which is the amplitude modulation. In reality, these two signals should go from the transmitter. Forget about the receiver side. From the transmitter side, should go the same distance. What I'm trying to find out, is it anything unusual that rules with the thinner signal through the air? Back to you.
If for the time being I throw away multipath modulation and say it doesn't exist, then there is no difference. If I keep the receiver bandwidth constant, and I create a level playing field, and if I don't have multipath, and if I use a 6 kilohertz wide signal or a 300 hertz wide signal, the exact same amplitude of signal arrives at the receiver. Without multipath considerations, they both have the same distance penetration capability, I think. Over to you, Wesley.
I think you're wrong. I think the secret is in the quite different place. The secret is with concentration of the power. When you put the same power, 10 kilograms or 10 pounds, on the needle, it goes further. When you put 10 pounds on something that is thick nail, then it doesn't go that much. Am I right?
You can do this experiment. You own a power meter. You own a signal generator. You can set the signal generator to 0 dBm. You can look at the power meter and see that it reads 0 dBm. You can now phase modulate the signal and make it 6 kilohertz wide. The power meter will not change. The same amount of power is received between your signal generator and the power meter. If I calculate the free space loss between a transmitting antenna and a receiving antenna, it does not change when I change the width of the signal. Over to you, Wesley.
I don't know. I would like Eric to say something about it, or Glenn. My understanding is that you have a 200 watt, and you push it 200 watt over the 300 hertz of the signal, and then you're putting the same 200 watt over 6 kilohertz. That must be something different. To compare the losses, maybe somebody else is going to comment on this.
Well, Wesley, if I do it the way I would normally do it, take yourself a 50 ohm resistor. Put 200 watts in a 50 ohm resistor. Put a 50 ohm resistor in a gallon of water. Okay? Transmit with no modulation and see how long it takes for the water to graze by 1 degree Celsius. Then, modulate your signal with 20 kilohertz or 100 kilohertz worth of bandwidth. And do the same thing again, and you'll find out that the rate that the water heats up is exactly the same.
Well, the explanation accepted. Respect to you.
I'll admit that this is a tough concept, and to picture it mentally is not easy. And until you do a few of those experiments, and Eric has, I've done a few of them, free space loss when you calculate it, not a function of bandwidth. Gain of the transmitting antenna, gain of the receiving antenna, not a function of bandwidth. The gain of the low noise amplifier in the receiver, for the most part, not a function of bandwidth. What is the function of bandwidth is the way the detector section of the receiver works. You allow the detector section, the IF bandwidth, the resolution bandwidth, to get more and more broad. The good news is it can listen to a wider and wider signal with higher and higher modulation rate. The bad news is it accepts more and more noise from the environment and from its own amplifiers. Every amplifier with greater bandwidth listens to more noise. Every time you double the bandwidth of your resolution amplifier in a receiver, under normal conditions, it will get twice the amount of noise for twice the amount of bandwidth. It's a direct proportion. It's a tough one to swallow, I know. Hey, fellas, we've gone almost an hour beyond. I've got to go to work tomorrow. I got a whole lot of people that are unhappy if I don't arrive a little earlier tomorrow. This was TechNet number 1,311 of the series that began in 1982, way back 27 and a half years ago. 73, you all. We're trying to settle some of these issues next week. We won't succeed, but we'll try. Mel, K2KEY, put some ribbons on it, Mel. K2RIW.
Okay, besides saying good night, I still didn't get my answers to a number of the questions on our discussion that we started out 1 hour ago on return loss. So I guess we'll ever get to it, Dick, but I'll keep it on the, as they say, on the back burner. All right, everyone, have a great week, and we'll try to do it again next week. And it's interesting, no doubt. I enjoy it, and so I hope the rest of you feel the same way. 73 is all. Have a good night. This is K2KEY.
Mel, why don't you say a few words on return loss? Go right ahead.
To say a few words because it's 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm going to say things, and we're going to get into at least a long discussion. So I'm not going to fall for that, you know, because I was going to go into some of the math as I see it, if I would apply it to actual use. Actually using a return loss bridge and the mathematics behind it and see how it coincides with his thinking. I don't know. There's something in this discrepancy there. Maybe I'm wrong, Dick, but we'll have to leave it for another time because it's not something I can do in a brief time over.
But I think there is one main point. Do you believe that a return loss bridge is a kind of a directional coupler? That you could say that a bird wattmeter, when it's measuring reverse power, is a kind of return loss bridge. I wonder if you feel that might be true. Over to you, Mel.
Of course. In fact, a return loss bridge also, in many cases, doubles as a hybrid combiner, Dick. Over.
Now give me a few words on that. How do you use a return loss bridge as a hybrid combiner? It's combining A and B. What is A and B?
Let's see. Let me give you, see if I can come up with a good example of using it as a combiner. I can't think right now. Let me see. I know, I can almost think of a way that you can use it with a two-tone system. In fact, I believe they used it in the early days of receiver performance tests, Dick. Over.
Okay. Modern-day receiver testing for dynamic range quite frequently is done as a two-tone test. And by the way, there's a variation of that called a three-tone test, but I won't go there. A two-tone test can tell you an awful lot about the dynamic range of anything that you would like to be linear, and you want to find out if it is a little bit nonlinear and how much. So a two-tone test. And maybe you're saying that a return loss bridge can sometimes be used as the signal, you might say it can bind the two signals, the two tones from the two transmitters. I think It can be a device that helps you do a two-tone test and remove the artifacts of your instrumentation. Is that sort of what you're saying, Mel?
Exactly, sure. The isolation will prevent the generators from interacting, and the two-tone test signal will be free from the intermodulation and distortion, so that it becomes basically a hybrid combiner for signal generators. So I think in fact that's what they, isn't that the way they used to always do the two-tone test on receivers back in the early days? I think the ARL lab used to do it by that method, Dick, over.
What about the phase of the two generators? Well, if I decide to set the two signal generators, let me pick a number, 1 kilohertz apart, and if I really receive them, set them at the 998 hertz apart instead of 1 kilohertz, I don't think that matters. What matters the most is you make sure that none of signal A gets into generator B and none of signal B gets into generator A. You need some kind of a combining device, an ideal isolated Wilkinson hybrid. Maybe there's ways of using a return loss bridge, but you need lots of isolation between the two SIG generators to generate the two tones. If you don't succeed in doing that, you'll be generating intermods in your instrumentation even before you measure the receiver, and it can confuse the daylights out of you. Over to you for a comment on that, Eric, and then pass it over to Mel.
No, I was going to suggest to Wilkinson, or a circulator for that matter. Go ahead, Mel.
Right, right. Combiners actually will mix two signals into one while simultaneously isolating the two signal sources. That is, I want to make sure I get the wording out of my head correctly. So, the isolation prevents the generators from interacting and provides basically a two-tone test signal that is free from the intermodulation or distortion. That is what I'm taking a classic combiner dick over.
Okay, I think you're saying if I set it up with the two signals on opposite diagonal corners of a thing that looks like a resistive Wheatstone bridge, I now can succeed in making those two signals thoroughly isolated from each other, and with some insertion loss of the return loss bridge or the Wheatstone bridge, I've got on one of those legs a combined signal where the two signals do not see each other, and therefore, in theory, I've got a very pure piece of instrumentation. I think that's what you're saying, Eric. Go ahead. Mel, go ahead.
Exactly. That's how they performed the two-tone test for receiver performance in the early days at the ARL. I remember I stood there and I watched them, how they do it, and I was very fascinated. That was one of the reasons that I got very fascinated with the RL return loss bridges, that they do this double duty thing, that they can act as this type of combiner. So, I was going to say that, you know, breaking it down, there's some advantages and disadvantages of measuring RLV, but one of the main advantages that I was going to really discuss is an antenna performance. As you say, using it as a directional coupler, over.
Now, when it comes to antenna performance, I was on a project some time ago where I had a combined two signals. Each of the signals was in the vicinity of 500 watts each. And after combination, the two signals had to be isolated from each other by 150 decibels, because I was looking for intermods of minus 150 dBc. When you've got instrumentation that can do that, and you've got to work real hard to do it, isolators, filters, combiners, circulators, in other words, it takes a weird combination. But when you do that, you would be amazed the amount of intermodulation distortion that can be resolved from a simple braided piece of coaxial cable.